Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Proverbs chapter 23, which I will entitle The Proverbs of Solomon, Part 14. We begin now in verses 1 through 3 of Proverbs 23. Solomon says, "When you sit down to dine with the ruler, consider carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat if you are a man of great appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for it is deceptive food." Now, John Gill has a great comment on this. What does it mean to consider carefully the food that is set before you by a great ruler? Gill says it means to not indulge to gluttony and drunkenness, and this person should consider also who is before him, which, since the words will bear, the ruler that has invited him and sits at the table with him, and take care that he says or does nothing that may give him offense, and also the noble personages that are guests with him, and behave towards them suitably to their rank and dignity, observe their words and conduct, and imitate the same. Yea, even he should consider the servants and waiters that attend, lest, behaving in an indecent and disorderly manner, they should report it to his disadvantage to their ruler or others. Now, this is a description of a meal that is not a family meal. It is a meal in which you will not enjoy the eating thereof. It reminds me of all the meals I ate in academic settings with all the deans and the provost and the presidents and all the big shots, and you have to sit there and worry about dropping something on your suit or saying something offensive, and so you sit there tight as a drum, being very, very careful that you don't do anything to hurt your career. This reminds me of a story I heard when I was in China. I used to teach at a college that was right next door to and connected to in various personal ways to a Fortune 500 company. And that company was in Shanghai, in China, to do business. They ended up making a bunch of Pringles potato chip cans all over the country. And while they were there, the CEO of this company and another junior executive were eating a meal with their Chinese counterparts as they were getting ready to do business. And the CEO of, it was Sunoco was the name of the corporation, the American corporation. The CEO of this corporation was very intelligent. He only pretended to drink when the Chinese said, "Ganbei," because what the Chinese do is they try to get you drunk so that they can take advantage of you. And the CEO of this corporation designated his junior executive as the one who would ganbei and who would turn his bottoms up and drink every time the Chinese asked him to drink. And as a result, everybody else was stone cold drunk at the table except the CEO of the corporation. And he was able to, with a clear head, negotiate an advantageous contract with the Chinese. So this proverb is very apropos even today. You need to consider carefully when you're amongst big shots eating a meal. Solomon says in verse 2, "Put a knife to your throat." Now, what does that mean? It basically means to bridle your tongue. Often people of great appetite drink too much as well, and when they eat and drink too much, they start saying foolish things that can get them in trouble. As Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 5:2, "Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God, for God is in heaven and you are on the earth, therefore let your words be few." Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that this expression, "put a knife to your throat," is an Eastern figure of speech that means putting restraint on the appetite. So even if you love to eat, don't eat and don't drink. Keep your wits about you. Verse 3, "Do not desire his delicacies, for it is deceptive food." Now, delicacies may be lawful, but they seduce to a life of wantonness and luxury. And of course, that's what the king is trying to do to you. He's trying to perhaps give you an appointment so that you can be of use to him. But remember, he's using you. The king might be feeding you in order to butter you up, just like you butter up a turkey before you eat it. Proverbs 23, verses 6 through 8 says this, "Don't eat a stingy person's bread, and don't desire his choice food, for it's like someone calculating inwardly. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you. You will vomit the little you've eaten and waste your pleasant words." Now, these words are found just a few verses later in this chapter. We'll get to them in just a minute. But Solomon's meaning is clear. Don't just take rewards from a man with power without considering carefully what he's doing, because he's going to use you. It is deceptive. deceptive food. We go now to Proverbs 23, verses 4 through 5. Solomon says, "Do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. When you set your eyes on it, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings, like an eagle that flies toward the heavens." Now, when Solomon says in verse 4, "Do not weary yourself to gain wealth," he means don't weary yourself to obsessive excess. It doesn't mean you can't get tired when you're working. I mean, Jesus himself, when he ministered, became hungry and thirsty, I think the scripture says. I'm sure he became tired too. That's normal, but it means don't spend your life trying to make money as if that's the only goal there is in life. The scriptures are very clear about this. 1 Timothy 6, 9 through 10, Paul says, "But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." I'll tell you a true story. I was with a brother who was a dedicated Christian, a former pastor even. He told me that he was tired of people who were only trying to become billionaires. He was aiming for his first $1 trillion. And I remember listening to this. I said, "That man is crazy." Well, he was pierced with many a pang because he ended up in the federal penitentiary for operating a Ponzi scheme, stole a bunch of my family's money, and was plunged into ruin and destruction. Proverbs 28:20, "A faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who makes haste to be rich will not go unpunished." Jeffrey Epstein died in a little cell. He was a billionaire at the time. Couldn't take it with him when he went. Proverbs 28:22, "A man with an evil eye hastens after wealth and does not know that want will come upon him." John Gill says, "Do not be always laying schemes, forming projects, inventing new things in order to get money. Or do not depend upon thine own wisdom and understanding and expect to be rich by means thereof." I believe in America this is the number one temptation. It's not women. It's money. Women might be a close second, but it's money that's number one. IPOs, I've gotten caught in it myself, lost a bunch of money myself. I deserved it. And I decided I'm not going to think about money anymore. And guess what? God has taken care of me perfectly. I didn't look at the stock market for 10 years. Not for 10 years. Because I was tired of worrying about it, thinking about it all the time. This is a great proverb. Do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. Verse 5, Solomon says, "When you set your eyes on it, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward the heavens," flies away from you. Now, this reminds me of a Roman god, and I can't remember his name, and I can't find him on Wikipedia, and I'm so sorry, but I never forget reading about this. This was a minor god, but it was a god of wealth. And when you look at this god, he would walk towards you with crutches, lame, limping, shuffling along, barely moving. And as he got closer and closer to you, this god of wealth, when he got even with you and he went past you, you'd turn around and all of a sudden he's healed. And he's got these big wings and he flies off, which is just a fancy way of saying that money is real, real hard to come by, but it's real easy to lose. Now, there's a balance to this. I remember when I read all of the Proverbs about laziness and how Solomon hates laziness. And I remember saying in a previous audio that I wasn't aware of another proverb that balanced that out. It says that we should not burn ourselves out. Well, actually, I was wrong, because here is a proverb right here, Proverbs 23, 4 through 5, which says, "Don't burn yourself out. Don't be weary chasing money." Here are some other proverbs that say, on the other hand, don't be lazy. Proverbs 10:4, "Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich." Proverbs 12:24, "The hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor." Proverbs 19:15, "Laziness cast into a deep sleep, and an idle man will suffer hunger." Proverbs 20:13, "Don't love sleep, or you will become poor. Open your eyes, and you'll have enough to eat." Proverbs 21:25, "A slacker's craving will kill him because his hands refuse to work." So the balance is you need to work, but don't put your eyes on money as the goal of your life. Because you do that, it'll fly away like an eagle. As John Gill says, this type of material wealth is not the true riches. They have only the shadow and appearance of riches. They are not lasting and durable. In a little time they will not be. They are perishing things. They have no substance or solidity in them. They are not satisfying. They do not make people happy. They are rather non-entities than realities, and therefore the eyes of the mind and the affections of the heart should not be set on them. America, of course, is a very materialistic nation. They don't compare, or we don't compare, to the Chinese. I've never seen people more materialistic than the Chinese. And they are getting ready to have their hearts pierced because money is fleeting. It is temporal. It vanishes faster than a crypto exchange. Proverbs 27:24 says, "For riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations." We go now to Proverbs 23, verses 6 through 8. Solomon says, "Do not eat the bread of a selfish man or desire his delicacies, for as he thinks within himself, so he is. He says to you, 'Eat and drink,' but his heart is not with you. You will vomit up the morsel you have eaten and waste your compliments." Of course, this is continuing what we read in the first three verses of this chapter, 23. Do not eat the bread of a selfish man. In verses 1 through 3, it was consider carefully the food that you're eating of a king. Well, we'll assume that the selfish man is the same as the king being selfish. He wants something out of you. Don't eat it. Don't take it. Reminds me when I first started practicing law, another established lawyer in my hometown asked me to eat, and then he was going to pay for my meal, and he was buttering me up. And I knew it, because I knew sooner or later I was going to have to do something he wanted me to do, and I didn't want to do it, and I didn't like that. But that's the way the world works, folks. People want to use you. They say, "Eat and drink," but their heart is not with you, as Solomon says. You will vomit up the morsel you have eaten. You might get a little bit of food at this nice banquet, but sooner or later, it's not going to be worth any more to you than the vomit that you vomit up. We go down to Proverbs 23, verse 9. Solomon says, "Do not speak in the hearing of a fool, for he will despise the wisdom of your words." This reminds one of Matthew 7:6, when Jesus says, "Do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, or they will trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces." Similar proverb is Proverbs 9:8. "Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you." Now, there are other proverbs that say to reprove a scoffer, not enjoining not to reprove a scoffer, so they seem like they contradict. For example, Proverbs 21:11, "When a mocker is punished, the inexperienced become wiser. When one teaches a wise man, he acquires knowledge." So in Proverbs 21, the mocker is punished. Proverbs 9:8, Solomon says, "Do not reprove a scoffer." Well, how can we reconcile that? Well, Proverbs 21:11 refers to the public rebuke of a scoffer, because it says, "When a mocker is punished, the inexperienced become wiser." In other words, onlookers get to see that the fool is rebuked. That's fine. But privately, it's a waste of time. You're just going to make him hate you. Another way you can reconcile those two proverbs is that Proverbs 9 says, "Do not reprove a scoffer," which means to correct him verbally, whereas Proverbs 21:11 says to punish the scoffer. Don't reprove him, but you can punish him. So you could reconcile it that way. I think the first way is better, though. One is talking about a public confrontation. One is talking about a private confrontation. Privately, don't waste your time, but publicly, there are other interests at stake. You've got to protect the public. In verse 9, Solomon says, "The fool will despise the wisdom of the wise man's words." Paul said the same thing to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 1, verse 25, "Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men." Now, of course, God is not foolish and God is not weak. Paul is just using a figure of speech here. But even if you could take the most foolish thing of God, that's still wiser than morons who go around saying they know more than God does. 1 Corinthians 2, verses 6 through 7, "Yet we do not speak wisdom among those who are mature. A wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away, but we speak God's wisdom in a mystery." When Paul says he speaks wisdom among those who are mature, he is implying that he does not speak wisdom to those who are immature, who are fools. Don't waste your breath on morons. Find that person who's got his eyes looking at you and he's interested in what you've got to say, and you can tell that he has an open mind. Then you spend all the time that's necessary to answer all his questions. But don't waste your time with morons. Life's too short. We go down to Proverbs 23, verses 10 through 11. Solomon says, "Do not move the ancient boundary or go into the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their case against you." And there's another proverb about stealing people's land in the previous chapter, chapter 22, verse 28. "Do not move the ancient boundary," Solomon says, "which your fathers have set." Moving land boundaries amounted to theft. And this theft right here was apparently perpetrated against poor people. Don't go into the fields of the fatherless. You move the boundary so you can move into their field. The fatherless are orphans. Well, they might be weak, Solomon says in verse 11, their Redeemer is strong. Now, their God is called a Redeemer. We're used to calling Jesus our Redeemer, but God is called a Redeemer too. This is not the only place in the Scriptures. That phrase, God's Redeemer is strong, here's an example of where the Redeemer is used of God. The Father, Jeremiah 50, verse 34. There, Jeremiah is referring to the Israelites and the Judeans, their Redeemer is strong. The Lord of hosts is his name. That's Yahweh. Capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, Yahweh. He redeemed Israel out of Egypt, for example, bought them out of slavery. He's strong. The God of orphans is strong. He will plead their case against you if there's some kind of a legal dispute between the poor and the man who moved the boundaries. God is going to be the attorney for the orphan. God loves orphans, orphans and widows. Psalm 68:5, a father of the fatherless and a judge for the widows is God in his holy habitation. The author of that psalm was David. Proverbs 22, verses 22 through 23. Solomon says, do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate. The gate is where they had lawsuits. For the Lord will plead their case and take the life of those who rob them. God is sort of like a cosmic public defender. You can't afford an attorney, God will take care of your case. And of course, the famous verse in James 1:27, pure and undefiled religion before our God and Father is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. Look after orphans and widows, pure and undefiled religion. We go now to Proverbs 23, verse 12. Solomon says, apply your heart to discipline and your ears to words of knowledge. Now, we have mentioned discipline many, many times in the book of Proverbs. I'm going to briefly go through some of the scriptures. We're going to see that the next two verses in this chapter also deal with discipline. So very quickly now, Proverbs 13:24. He who withholds his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. Proverbs 19:18. Discipline your son while there is hope and do not desire his death. While there is hope means before he ends up in a slammer, when he'll still listen to you. Proverbs 3:12, for whom the Lord loves, he reproves, even as a father corrects the son in whom he delights. Hebrews 12, verses 5 through 6, and you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. Revelation 3:19, those whom I love, I reprove and discipline. Therefore be zealous and repent. Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. Proverbs 22:15, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. Proverbs 29:17, correct your son and he will give you comfort, he will also delight your soul. Well, we get the idea. We can summarize all that by saying, discipline your child. Solomon's not finished, though. We go now to Proverbs 23, verses 13 through 14. Solomon says, do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with the rod, he will not die. You shall strike him with the rod and rescue his soul from Sheol. Now, he will die. Sheol means death. He'll die if you don't discipline, but if you strike him with a rod in punishment, he won't die. Now, of course, that implies that you don't beat the mud out of him in a cruel, abusive way. You just inflict discipline on him. We have to be careful now when we talk now, because as soon as you talk about corporal punishment, the humanist morons who now control our culture will start screaming, child abuse! No, it's not child abuse. It's child abuse not to strike the child with a rod. Now, of course, some people could argue that the rod is only used as a symbol of discipline. Okay, it's child abuse if you don't discipline child, if you want to be loose about it. Proverbs 23, verses 15 through 18. My son, if your heart is wise, my own heart also will be glad. And my inmost being will rejoice when your lips speak what is right. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in the fear of the Lord always. Surely there is a future, and your hope will not be cut off. Now here we have a proverb that talks about the joy of fathers who have decent sons. Wise sons. Wise sons make happy fathers. And I might add mothers too, although Solomon doesn't mention mothers here. I'm going to read you a bunch of scriptures, some of which mention happy mothers also. 1 Thessalonians 2, 19 through 20. And not only physical sons, but also spiritual sons make their spiritual fathers happy. 1 Thessalonians 2, 19 through 20. For who is our hope or joy or crown of exaltation? Is it not even you in the presence of our Lord Jesus at his coming? For you are our glory and joy. Paul is talking about his spiritual children there. I know there's a young Chinese student I led to the Lord about 10 years ago, and her father ended up in jail. He was a criminal. She had no father, and I said, well, you want a father? I'll be your substitute father. Ooh, if I'd have known what I was getting myself into. But anyway, it's been 10 years later, and I have given her all kinds of spiritual advice and financial advice and marriage advice and parent. I haven't given her too much parenting advice yet. I think I'm worn out. But I've given her a lot of advice. She is basically my spiritual daughter, and she's doing real well now. And it makes me happy when I think about it, when I think that God can redeem a life that was so screwed up and so messed up and with such few prospects of success later in life. And she's doing so well, happily married, going to church, gotten out of China, got two twin kids, and she's doing great. She loves the Lord. She prays all the time. Yeah, that makes my heart glad. John says in 2 John 1:4, John says, I was very glad to find some of your children walking in truth. John is writing to a church. Just as we have received commandment to do from the Father. He's glad to see the spiritual children walking in truth. 3 John 1:4, John says, I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in the truth. Spiritual children. Now going back to natural children in Proverbs 10 verse 1, a wise son, Solomon says, makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. Proverbs 23 verses 24 through 25, that's later on in our chapter here. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who sires a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her rejoice who gave birth to you. Proverbs 17:21, he who sires a fool does so to his sorrow, and the father of a fool has no joy. That's the flip side. A wise son brings joy, a foolish son brings no joy. Proverbs 17, verse 25, a foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her who bore him. Proverbs 27:11, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad that I may reply to him who reproaches me. Proverbs 28:7, he who keeps the law is a discerning son, but he who is a companion of gluttons humiliates his father. Proverbs 29:3, a man who loves wisdom makes his father glad, but he who keeps company with harlots wastes his wealth. Now, what all these verses show is that a son cannot live his life without affecting his father or his mother. That's just the way it is, folks. And if you think that you can get away from your parents and then go out and raise hell, well, you will be affecting your parents because you will always be their child. Nothing's going to stop that. Nothing's going to render that nugatory. There is nothing closer than a blood tie between a parent and a child. So, you want to make your parent happy? It might be you better be wise. We go now to Proverbs 23:19 through 21. Listen, my son, and be wise, and direct your heart in the way. Do not be with heavy drinkers of wine or with gluttonous eaters of meat. For the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe one with rags. Somebody who drinks a lot and eats a lot, they get sleepy. They don't want to work. Now notice that in verse 20, Solomon says, do not be with heavy drinkers of wine. Heavy drinkers. He didn't say do not be with drinkers of wine. The scripture clearly allows for moderate drinking of wine. I realize that there's some fundamentalists who think otherwise, but they're wrong, in my humble opinion. Don't be with heavy drinkers of wine. This is an exhortation against drinking to excess. Now, I read a blob article by a young Christian, Generation Z, millennial, I can't remember. But he said, in his experience with his fellow Christians, he thinks that Christians are going too far in the other direction. Oh, I'm free now. And so they start drinking hard liquor. And I've seen a little bit of that. In my humble opinion, you ought to stay away from hard liquor. Wine is only, what, 12% alcohol? Beer is 2% alcohol? But you start drinking 200-proof stuff that's 100% alcohol, all you're doing is poisoning your gut. You're most likely going to get drunk. But I won't make a law about it because I can't prove it from the scripture, but it just doesn't make sense to play with fire, if you ask me. Don't get drunk. If you drink that stuff and you're drinking to get a buzz, same thing with smoking marijuana. You're doing that to get your mind at ease, but then you're finding a substitute for the Holy Spirit of Christ. And that cannot be honoring to God. It cannot be. So Solomon is saying here that the glutton and the heavy drinker will come to poverty. Another similar proverb is Proverbs 21, verse 17. He who loves pleasure will become a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not become rich. If a man is concerned only with consumption and not with production, he will consume everything he has, and he'll be poor. Now, Adam Clark suggests that there are reasons why there are so many proverbs against carousing and feasting. Number one, says Clark, the useless expense. Number two, the loss of time. Number three, the danger from bad company. And four, the danger of contracting irregular habits and of being induced to lead a voluptuous and effeminate life. Stay away from all these parties. You'll be happier. Go to Proverbs 23:22. Listen to your father who begot you, and do not despise your mother when she is old. Now, many young men think their mothers are silly and their instructions are old wives' tales. No, when your mother is old, she's just wiser. She's not more superfluous. Adam Clark says that old women are generally, quote, helpless, useless, and burdensome. That's true when women get old. In fact, when anybody gets old, people start thinking, well, let's put him out to pasture. He led a great life when he was a thoroughbred, but now just let him munch on the grass. I was just talking to a 71-year-old friend of mine who's active in ministry, and he says that this attitude is everywhere. In his experience, in his town where he is, they think that basically you've shot your wad. Your musket has been fired, and there ain't nothing left but smoke coming out of the barrel. Contrast that with the Chinese attitude of age. I was 59 and a half years old in a taxi. Taxi driver asked me how old I was. I was in China. And I told him 59, and he started gushing and saying, oh, that's wonderful. How blessed you are. He didn't say blessed, but how wonderful you are. How lucky you are. And I couldn't figure that out. And so I asked some Chinese friends, I says, why is this taxi driver so happy that I'm 59 years old? What's the big deal about 59? And they said, it's not 59, it's 60 the next year, because that's a special year. If you make it to 60 in Chinese culture, you are most honored. Try to find that attitude in America. Well, this is a biblical attitude. Don't despise your parents when they get old. Now, it says don't despise your mother when she's old, but as these couplets usually do, that also probably means the father in the first part of the verse. Listen to your father who begot you. He's probably old, too. Listen to them. Now, does that mean that you obey them even when you are an adult? It says listen to your father. It doesn't say obey your father. I mean, when you become the head of your family, you've got to make your own family decisions. I would never tell my grown adult son how to run his family. Well, I remember my atheist father, I asked him for advice all the time. Well, no spiritual advice, of course, but financial advice, mechanical advice. Oh boy, I asked him all the time. Here's some other scriptures. Similar, Proverbs 1:8, hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Listen to your parents. Ephesians 6:1, New Testament, Paul says to the Ephesians, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Now, of course, that's talking about young children, not adults, but the principle is true at all times, assuming the parents don't ask you to go out and rob a bank or something like that. If it's just a matter of raising you, listen to them, obey them, because kids love to rebel. Having been one myself, I know how it is. Proverbs 23, verses 23 through 25. Solomon says, buy truth and do not sell it. Get wisdom and instruction and understanding. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who sires a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her rejoice who gave birth to you. Now, we just mentioned verses 24 and 25 just a minute ago. Verse 23, Solomon says, buy truth and do not sell it. Truth has a cost. So truth must have value to the person obtaining it. Truth is hard to come by. It's like money. So once you get it, don't sell it at any price. If truth didn't have value, the person desiring truth wouldn't have paid the cost to get it. Adam Clark says, too much pains, industry, and labor cannot be expended in order to get truth. Getting truth is a lonely, lonely task because most of the people in this world are fools. Now, I know that might sound arrogant to say, and I don't think anybody has a monopoly on wisdom, but in certain narrow aspects of life, you can get wisdom and be wiser than everybody around you, but it's not easy. You have to learn from the school of hard knocks. You've got to learn from your parents. You've got to learn from your culture. You've got to learn what to reject from your culture. You've got to go to other people who are outside your zone of comfort, especially when you're talking about theology. You want to hear about the doctrines of grace in a charismatic or Pentecostal or Methodist or Baptist church, typical Baptist church, you're not going to hear it. You've got to go to a Reformed Baptist or a Presbyterian church to hear that. You want to hear about spiritual gifts like prophecy and glossolalia? Well, you can go to a Presbyterian church and sit there and listen to sermons till the cows come home, and you will never hear a word about it. If you want truth, you got to go get it, and you got to work for it. And once you get it, don't just abandon it. No matter how much is offered for you to part with the truth, when persecution comes, the temptation is very strong to sell. We go now to Proverbs 23, verses 26 through 28. Solomon says, "Give me your heart, my son, and let your eyes delight in my ways. For a harlot is a deep pit, and an adulterous woman is a narrow well. Surely she lurks as a robber and increases the faithless among men." Now Solomon has many, many, many exhortations against going into prostitutes and adulteresses, and I'm not going to read them all to you. Chapter 5, I think it's a whole chapter devoted to the topic. But let me read Proverbs 22, verse 14. "The mouth of an adulteress is a deep pit. He who is cursed of the Lord will fall into it." Here in Proverbs 23, verse 27, "The harlot is a deep pit and a narrow well." Harlot and adulterous woman are put in parallel there. A harlot is not necessarily an adulteress, and an adulteress is not necessarily a harlot, but it's the same idea. They're both committing sexual immorality. And they will put the man who goes into such a woman into a situation that he can't get out of. A deep pit, you can't get out of it. Narrow well, same thing, you can't get out of it. In verse 28, "This immoral woman lurks as a robber. She'll rob you of your life." Let me read one more of Solomon's anti-adultery scriptures, anti-adulterous scriptures. Proverbs 6:23-29, "For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching is light, and reproofs for discipline are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for the precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom, and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is the one who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished." Now there's an interesting addition to the wealth of wisdom that Solomon has concerning adulteresses. He says in verse 28, Proverbs 23, that she increases the faithless among men. This implies that a fallen husband might not have fallen but for the adulteress. She increases faithfulness. If she had not been there, maybe the men would not have been faithless to their wives. In fact, I think that's probably a very good probability that that would be true. Nobody available? Well, then the men wouldn't stray. She lurks as a robber in verse 28. John Gill says, "There is none that occasions more sin or makes more sinners than a whorish woman. Swearing, lying, drunkenness, thieving, stealing, housebreaking, robbing on the highway, or the sins she leads into. She increases treachery, treachery to God, to their king, to their wives, to their masters, and all that they may consume, what they can get by perfidious practices upon them. Or she gets a parcel of abandoned wretches about her, whom she employs as her panders for her lust, or as bullies to spoil her gallants of their substance, or murder them for the sake of it." Well, that's some flamboyant rhetoric against the adulteress. We go down to Proverbs 23, verses 29 through 35, and we will finish this chapter. Solomon says, "Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes?" Answer, verse 30, "Those who linger long over wine, those who go to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your mind will utter perverse things. And you will be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea, or like one who lies down on the top of a mast. They struck me, but I did not become ill. They beat me, but I did not know it. When shall I awake? I will seek another drink." Verse 35 is a quotation of a drunk man, an hypothesized drunk man. Verse 29, Solomon proceeds from adultery and whoredom in the previous set of verses, and now he goes into drunkenness. That's a logical progression. He's already said in this chapter, in verse 20, a few verses previous, don't associate with those who drink too much wine. And so now he's going after drunkenness. In verse 29, he says, who has wounds without cause? He says that because oftentimes drunkards fight over frivolous causes. You've seen the movies. Fight over stupid things. So this drunkard has woe, he has sorrow, he has fights, contentions, he complains, his eyes are red. In verse 30, he says it happens because these drunkards taste mixed wine. Now, why mixed wine? John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say that mixed wine is stronger than regular wine. As Gill says, the wine is either, quote, mixed with spices to make it more palatable or with different sorts of wine, some very strong and more heady and intoxicating. Although it's true that mixed wine could be wine mixed with water, I'm not sure that mixed wine is stronger than average wine because wine can only ferment up to a certain amount of alcohol, about 12%. You put other stuff in it, it's not going to really make it stronger. I think probably what Solomon is just using an adjective to describe the kind of wine that people normally drank at banquets mixed with spices and such. In verse 31, he says, do not look at the wine when it is red, when it sparkles. Ooh, that makes it attractive. Jameson, Fawcett, and Bryan say that the redder the wine is, the greater the strength it is. Well, I guess that would be true if you're cutting it with water. But it sparkles in the cup. Oh, yes, it seems so nice. But verse 32, at the last, it bites like a serpent. As John Gill says, it leaves a sting behind it. Intemperately drank, a nausea in the stomach, a stink in the breath, pains and giddiness in the head, weakness in the eyes, trembling in the members of the body, palsy, gout, and other distempers, very painful and grievous to be borne. I tell you, this John Gill's got away with words. That sounds like a real bad hangover. Now, of course, the sting that Solomon is talking about here, or the bite, stings like a viper, bites like a serpent. That bite, that sting, could refer to the after effects in one's life when one becomes a drunkard. But more probably is referring to the aftertaste of wine and the physical effects that come after one gets drunk on wine. Verse 33, Solomon says, your eyes will see strange things, like the proverbial pink elephant, as you hallucinate in your drunkenness. It's interesting. The King James says, your eyes will see strange women. Come on. You get drunk and you see adulteresses in your drunken haze? I don't think so. I like the pink elephant's idea. Strange things. Your mind will utter perverse things, perverted things. That's what perverse means. In verse 34, Solomon says, you, the drunken person, will be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea. Well, now you think, how can somebody lie down in the middle of the sea? You would drown. And that's the way I took it at first. You lie down in the sea and you're a dead man. You're drunk. You're stiff as a board and the waves wash over you and you die. But John Gill says, no, it's not in the open sea that Solomon is talking about. The drunkard is not in the open sea and the waves of it, they're fluctuating and tossed about, nor in an island encompassed by sea, but in a ship at sea. In a ship at sea, a drunken man reels and tumbles about, just as a ship does at sea. Hence, the motions and agitations of it and of the men in it are compared to the reeling and staggering of a drunken man. And so, Gill says that what Solomon means here is the drunken man lies down on a boat in the middle of the sea and the boat rocks it around. And the boat rocks up and down, even as a drunk staggers around the floor. At the end of verse 34, Solomon says the drunk is like one who lies down on the top of a mast. Well, if you fall asleep in the little crow's nest at the top of a mast, it's just a matter of time before the drunkard will crash to the deck, or he will fall into the sea and be drowned. It's dangerous to be asleep at the top of a mast. And verse 35, Solomon quotes a hypothetical drunkard. The drunkard says this, they struck me, but I did not become ill. That's because he's so drunk he can't feel getting hit, which means he's being damaged and his nervous system is not performing its normal duty of warning the body to protect itself. They beat me, but I did not know it. When shall I awake? Because he's out of it. And as soon as he gets awake, he says, I will seek another drink. He doesn't know when to stop. Well, I think we have a very good indication of what God and Solomon think about drunkenness. You don't have to be a spiritual giant to know that alcohol kills. It's one of the worst curses that ever came upon mankind if you've ever known alcoholics and how it destroys families and destroys individuals. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Proverbs 23 and we are now prepared to go to our next audio, which is Proverbs 24. I will entitle that audio, The Proverbs of Solomon, Part 15. I hope you stay tuned to get some more wisdom in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.